I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Zvi Eckstein, author of the new book, The Chosen Few, exploring why and how Jews as a people became urban, educated, and proficient in the skills needed to succeed in the modern world. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I saw a very entertaining movie with my family the other day called When Comedy Went to School, about the development, flourishing, and eventual demise of the Catskill Mountain Resorts in New York that incubated stand-up comedy for all of America. The sheer number and quality of the great comedians who came through the many hotels, guest houses, and bungalow colonies in the Green Hills, 2 hours north of New York City, is astonishing. Everyone from Danny Kaye to Jack Benny to Henny Youngman to Milton Berle to George Burns to Sid Caesar to Jerry Lewis to Mel Brooks to Don Rickles to Jackie Mason to Joan Rivers to Alan King to Rodney Dangerfield to Robert Klein to Woody Allen to Lenny Bruce to Buddy Hackett to Jerry Stiller to Billy Crystal to Jerry Seinfeld and many, many more got their start doing stand-up comedy for Jews on vacation from the heat and humidity of the Big Apple in the summer. If you get a chance to see this documentary, When Comedy Went to School, of the famed Borscht Belt, do it, because it traces the connection between Judaism and humor as well as anyone ever has. There are many funny stories and, of course, funny lines in the film. My favorites included one about, I was so thrilled to finally meet the woman who would become my wife, Ms. Wright. Of course, I didn't realize that her first name was Always. And the always popular routine of Jackie Mason's about everything depends on your point of view. For example, to me, my girlfriend is the most wonderful, remarkable person in the entire world. That's to me. But to my wife. But the most interesting routine in the film came from a comedian I have never particularly enjoyed, Mort Saul, who was actually the very first stand-up comedian to ever be on the cover of Time magazine. Way back in 1960, he invented political and social commentary as stand-up comedy. Mort Saul's routine included this piece. There's a lot of Jewish people who have an influence on Western philosophy disproportionate to our numbers. Moses invented the law because everybody used to pillage and steal everybody's cattle, but nobody wanted to obey. Then after him, Jesus, also Jewish, he invented forgiveness in case somebody broke the law, but that didn't work. Nobody wanted to do that. They cared too much about their cattle. Then came Marx, who said, if you can't obey the law and you can't forgive those who transgress against you, could you share with them? But people hated that. They were appalled by the idea. Then came Freud, who proposed that people at least understand each other. But again, nobody wanted to do that. And the last great Jewish thinker was Einstein, who wrote a letter to FDR saying they'd figured out a way to build a bomb that could blow up the whole world. And that, said Mort Saul, caught on. Well, beyond the shtick, his list of the most major Jewish thinkers who profoundly influenced the course of civilization is pretty impressive, without even including St. Paul or Maimonides or Theodor Herzl or many others. Moses, Jesus, Marx, Freud, and Einstein, while not exactly conventional Jewish thinkers who reside on some Yiddish version of Mount Rushmore, are nonetheless extraordinary minds who transformed human thought, belief, practice, experience. Which raises a question that we'll explore in some depth with our guest today. Why is it that a relatively tiny people, who until quite recently were without land or an army, managed to shape so much of the thought and development of Western civilization? As you'll hear later in the news of Jews today, 5 more Jewish scientists won the Nobel Prize this month, continuing a long trend, and the new head of the Fed, the most important player in the American economy, will again be Jewish. And she is succeeding 2 more Jews who have held that post for the past quarter century. 1/3 of the Supreme Court is Jewish, over 10% of the Farkakta U.S. Senate, and so on. This is too much success for any people of our limited numbers to be just a happy accident. So, what does it all mean? Are we smarter than everybody else by some biological DNA fluke? Are Jews as a race somehow given divine help that allows us to rise high in intellectual circles and societal realms? Actually, no. We are not gifted with an extra seichel chromosome that helps us in school or blesses us with some secret supreme ability to be doctors and lawyers. We are made of the same stuff as all other human beings. But there's a difference in one area, and it's a cultural one, and it's very important. For a complete exploration, you just have to keep listening to Too Jewish this morning, but the core of that difference is that there's something profoundly important in our cultural insistence in Judaism on learning, education, cultivating the life of the mind. You can even see this linguistically. Eskimos are said to have 180 different words for snow and ice. Jews have nearly as many words for learning and studying and teaching. The word Torah, so integral to Jewish life, means instruction, as do the words for most of our other classic texts. Mishnah, Gemara, Talmud, Midrash, they all mean learning or studying or teaching in some form or another. A Jewish home without books, even in this electronic age of the Kindle and all the other readers, is inconceivable. We are not so much the people of the book as we are the people of many books. It is that near-obsessive emphasis on education, on reading, learning, teaching, and challenging ourselves to know better and understand more deeply that's at the heart of our contemporary success. The historical origins and impact of all of this we'll examine in greater detail this morning with our guest a little later, but it's worth noting again that with all the hue and cry about the recent release of the Pew study showing Jews are less religiously connected than ever before, that there's nothing to demonstrate that these core values of learning, teaching, and expanding the life of the mind are not still very much alive and well among Jews today. And that should give us not only encouragement, but also great hope. Because in the marketplace of ideas that is America, that is really all of the West, Judaism can more than rise to the challenge. To play us in this fine morning, here's a cut from our Mon Bizman, the new Shabbat evening service that was written by Sam Golden and Bob Hanshaw and is becoming a Friday night sensation. It's their version of Shalom Rav. Grant peace, abundant peace to our people.
Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam. Shalom. Amcha tasim le'olam, ki ata hu melech adom, lecho ha'shalom, ki ata hu melech adom, lecho ha'shalom, shalom rav Yisrael. Amcha tasim le'olam, shalom rav Yisrael. Amcha tasim le'olam, v'torinecha levarech et amcha Yisrael. Bechol et uvechol sha'a Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Le'olam. Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Le'olam. Tasim Le'olam, Tasim Le'olam.
That was Shalom Rav from the Friday night service, Armon Bizman, which means a palace in time, a lovely name for what Shabbat truly can be. Why are Jews so smart, people ask? How can a group that is less than 1% of the world's population win over 20% of the Nobel Prizes? This morning, you're going to find out. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Dean Zvi Eckstein of the Interdisciplinary Institute in Tel Aviv and the co-author of a fascinating book, Chosen Few, that explains why and how we Jews became proficient in the skills that allowed us to succeed so remarkably in the modern world. Find out when we come back on Two Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Zvi Eckstein. He's the Dean of the School of Economics at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, which is an interesting institution in and of its own right. His book and his thesis are called The Chosen Few, a very interesting analysis of the history of the development of the Jewish people. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hi, good morning.
So, most people, when they think about what happened to the Jews, sooner or later come to the question, how come Jews are so smart? So, tell us, why are Jews so smart?
Well, I don't know. The question is whether the Jews are so smart. I think the point is that Jews are in the recent 50, 60 years, in the maybe more 100 years in the U.S., in a lot of high professions, in academics, in Nobel Prizes, Pulitzer Prizes, in the movies, in writing, and many ways. So I think it more has to do with their academic achievements and learning achievement and attitude toward education, and using that as a vehicle of upscaling themselves in occupations and in the standard of living. And that is a phenomena of recently, I mean, before, I think Jews were basically based in what we call urban occupation as professionals, as moneylenders, financiers, doctors, and but overall, any activities which was urban related, and some of them were very poor in the past. And our book deal with basically far back in the history how that has been evolved over the years.
So there's
and
a
the bottom line that it came from adoption of mandatory education for the males, part of the Jewish religion. Immediately after the destruction of the temple in the first century.
There's a certain irony of this, of course. When Jews were living in their own country with their own leaders, the temple, the focus on religion, we weren't necessarily particularly accomplished economically, politically, or in other ways. That the diaspora, in order for Jews to survive, compelled us to have to focus on literacy. Is it your contention in the book that Jewish literacy wasn't particularly high when we were in Israel in the first place?
Yeah, Jews emphasized the transformation in the Jewish religion actually occur almost immediately after the destruction of the temple. The rabbis who become the leaders of the Jewish people at that time were part of the Pharisees group who opposed to the rebellion against the Romans, and survived this rebellion, and they established the new center of Judaism within Israel, where a large proportion of the Jews who survived the rebellion lived in Israel at that time. And they transformed the religion based on the idea that the key of replacing the sacrifices in the temple, and as the temple was destroyed, is to really build a Jewish religion that is based on reading the Torah, learning the Torah, learning the rules, and live by the Torah rules as the center of Judaism, building synagogues and teaching there the boys to read Hebrew Torah. And that became the implementation of this idea by the rabbis, which went on since then and intensified by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi when he compiled the key book of the Jews at that time, the Mishnah, which interpret the Torah to everyday life of a Jew who is living in Israel as a farmer. So it was not built to a Jewish religion, which is in the diaspora, which happened several centuries later, almost six centuries later. You learn the evolution of Judaism. It was always centered about farmers who are reading the Torah in the synagogue in the land of Israel.
So we'll talk when we come back on Too Jewish, Professor Zvi Eckstein, about how that became an entirely new culture over the course of time. When we return, just a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, where you can stream all the shows and download our podcasts at Apple iTunes Store. Very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome Ramivi Naan Israel Oshrat Barel, who is the Shlicha, the head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson, Arizona. Good morning, Oshrat. Boker Tov, welcome.
Good morning, Rabbi.
One of the fascinating things as a visitor to Israel, and I'm going back with a temple trip in June, is the remarkable change in the infrastructure, highways, trains. Israel used to have a very shaky highway network, and the train system was antiquated. It was on Ottoman schedules, I think. Suddenly, or it seems to us suddenly, a tremendous infrastructure has developed. Why has Israel begun to invest in this kind of development?
First, we're almost 66, so it's about time. But
almost 66 years old. It's time to grow up already.
Yeah.
No more teenager.
No teenager anymore. And there is several reasons. And I guess one of them, we spoke a little bit in the earlier show about, you know, the difference between the center and the periphery, and the fact that the real estate in the center, it's too high. It's too expensive for young couples to live in the center. So infrastructure will allow people, young couple, to live like out of Tel Aviv and to drive an hour and a half the morning and at evenings and get back to, you know, the home that they can afford themselves. So this is part of the reason.
You know, I think about the development of places like Modi'in, which was really a small town not very long ago. Now it's a fast-growing city.
Oh my God, it's a big city, and it's one of the cities that well known because it was planned very well before they built it, so they have all the infrastructure very well. But I want to also share about my hometown, Beit She'an, that, you know, far away in the north. But we are about to have a new train that will use the old infrastructure for the train that went from Haifa to Damascus. So they will use almost the same
path. The same road for the train.
Mm-hmm. But we will have a new train 2 years, 3 years from now.
And it'll make it possible for people to work in Haifa area,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, it will. We hope that lots of young families will get back and live near their families that, you know, it's always good, and be able to work at high tech and any other jobs that they have, and, you know, to be able to have their own homes in near their families and friends.
And be able to have a nice home.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet still have a successful job in an area which isn't affordable.
A win-win.
Yeah, a win-win for everybody. It's becoming like a European country.
Yeah, some of the cities are exactly, you know.
I don't expect that train to go on to Damascus, however, anytime soon, like it did in the days of the Turkish Empire.
Yeah. No, thank you. Not right now.
Thanks, Oshrod. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week, we started talking about your recent trip to Europe, Eastern Europe, in which you attended three weddings, well, sort of Central and Eastern Europe, in which there was somebody sort of Jewish getting married in each of them. A father was Jewish or a mother was Jewish. They had a Jewish affiliation in some way. And yet they were civil ceremonies. Fill us in a little bit more on kind of what that means.
Right. So some local color. They were all very interesting, and I don't want to reveal too many intimate details about my friends on the air, so I won't use any names. But in one case, it was two young people who had grown up in Milano, although both were of mixed national origins, and they decided to get married in Istanbul, where the bride had family connections and parts of her family had lived for many years. In fact, she had a very charming cousin there seated at my table who lived in Istanbul till she was 16 and spoke fluent Turkish. Now, the bride was the daughter of a Jewish mother. So technically, by Israeli law and by halakha and by almost any definition, she's Jewish, although she doesn't practice anything. The groom has no Jewish connections whatsoever, except he has many Jewish friends. And they had a purely civil ceremony, which interestingly was conducted on Turkish soil, but by a justice of the peace that they flew in from Milano and who performed the ceremony in accordance with Italian civil law. It was all a very interesting mix. Nationalities, cultures, right on the waters of the Bosphorus. I mean, the sort of platform on which the wedding took place was literally 2 yards from the waters of the Bosphorus. It was quite a splendid setting, and it was a lovely evening. The next wedding, which was less than 24 hours later, was in Belgrade. It was also performed in a purely secular way by a justice of the peace or some official from Belgrade City Hall. And in this case, the groom has a Jewish father and Jewish grandparents and whatever. But according to Israeli law, if he wanted to become an Israeli citizen by virtue of the law of return, he would have to convert because technically he's not Jewish. However, he always grew up with an active affiliation with the Jewish community. He played in various Maccabi teams. He has thought about moving to Israel, but he doesn't want to leave his parents, quote unquote, alone when they get old. And he's fairly sure that his younger sister will move somewhere else. So he put on hold any plans to make Aliyah. And in the third case, it was two very secular people from both mixed backgrounds in Vienna who had a civil ceremony, but both have, you know, at least a grandparent who's Jewish, as so many people in Vienna do. It was a melting pot of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. There were all kinds of cultural influences there too, but that's the nature of Vienna. I mean, as opposed to real German, the Viennese use Hungarian and Croatian and Serbian words for very basic things like tomatoes and apricots and whatever. They don't use German because they use the various languages of their former empire. And you felt that very much in this wedding. It was quite an interesting series and raises different kinds of questions, or at least lends an additional perspective to our future consideration of the findings of this survey that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about, you know, what constitutes Jewish identity in the year 2013 and going forward, how that's changed not only in Europe, but of course in America too. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Two Jewish is a Public Service. Arnold is 29 years old. He still lives at home. He comes down to breakfast one morning after a great night out. As soon as he sits down, he says to his parents, "Mom and Dad, you'll be pleased to hear. I met an amazing girl last night. I was so captivated by her beauty and charm. By the end of the night, I could clearly see that we are going to end up under the chuppah. At last, your son has found someone. What do you think of that?" And his father replies, "Well, Arnold, it sounds like something is happening for you at last, but it's important for you to marry somebody who has the same belief as your family." "But Dad," says Arnold, "why would I want to marry a girl who thinks I'm a schmuck?" Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Vayera, which includes the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah, in which God tests Abraham by having him almost, but not quite, sacrifice his son Isaac on a rock. Famous for being read on the first day of Rosh Hashanah by Reform Jews and the second day by conservative and Orthodox Jews, its connection to Rosh Hashanah would seem to be the fact that a ram appears at the end of the story, caught in a thicket by its horns. The model for all future shofars. But this passage, taken from the Torah portion of Vayera, is much more than a mere animal story. Cryptic and oddly repetitive, it raises a host of painful moral dilemmas, challenging us to think intensely about just what our relationship with God truly is. According to the text, God tests Abraham, Adonai Nisa et Avram, by commanding him to sacrifice his son, his only son, his beloved son Isaac. That triple identification mirrors an earlier command in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha to Abraham to begin his great journey towards God and monotheism. Leave your land, leave your birthplace, leave your father's home. Now Abraham is being told to kill his son, his only son, his beloved son. There are problems in the text. Abraham is another older son, Ishmael, the father of the Arabs, by the way, so Isaac is not truly his only son. In fact, Isaac is actually the son of his older age with his wife Sarah, and Isaac is Sarah's only son. Clearly, all God had to say was, "Take your son Isaac," and there'd be no doubt about who is supposed to go up on the sacrificial altar. Why the extra language? But the biggest problem is the simple fact that Abraham, who has previously shown a great tendency to argue and even fight injustice bravely, obeys this terrible command and does so with apparent relish. He gets up early in the morning. He doesn't make a peep, doesn't say a single word of objection to God as he goes about the tasks to sacrifice his son. The narrative itself sets up the drama beautifully, painfully, even tragically. Isaac doesn't know what is being done, goes along with his father. The phrase, "the two walked on together," is repeated. Isaac asks, "Where's the lamb for the burnt offering?" A very sweet and sad and bitter kind of question. Abraham replies correctly, but ironically, "Oh, God will provide." It's a weird, a deeply troubling scene. And then as Abraham is about to slaughter his son, an angel of God does intervene, and the murder of the innocent, the sacrifice of Isaac, is averted. He lives, and the future of our people, Abraham's children, is thus preserved. This story in its place and time was undoubtedly a polemical tale designed to teach the prohibition on human sacrifice because, of course, Isaac doesn't get killed. Children are not supposed to be slaughtered on the altar of their parents' beliefs. God does not want the blood of a human lamb. Our Lord does not truly desire the destruction of his own children. God, in fact, desires life. Other religions have taken this Akedah story to a different, bloodier, more horrible conclusion, believing that human sacrifice and suffering are the essential elements in a religious life. But the story of the binding of Isaac makes it clear that killing our own kids and the glorification of the loss of a child will never be acceptable to Jews. Abraham's urgent rush to fulfill God's weird and painful command to kill his son reminds us that we can embrace morally bad decisions with great religious fervor if we're not careful. And many, many times in human history, we have sent our children off to die for causes that were simply wrong. The great World War I poet Wilfred Owen paraphrased this theme in his piece, The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they sojourned, both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth the knife to slay his son. When lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him, thy son. Behold, caught in a thicket by its horns, a ram. Offer the ram of pride instead. But the old man would not do so, but slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one. Wilfred Owen wrote of the ways in which his elders sent his own generation off to die in the trenches of World War I. But you know, we still engage in such odd choices. Like Abraham, we still often fail the test. May we contemporary human beings learn from the Torah and from this Akedah test of Abraham's to choose life, not sacrifice, for our own children. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Tzvi Eckstein, will explain just why Jews keep winning Nobel Prizes and other mysteries of Jewish survival and thriving throughout history when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Ovadia Yosef, the rabbi responsible for turning religiously observant Sephardic Jews from a marginalized minority in Israel into one of the country's most politically powerful groups, the former chief Sephardic rabbi of Israel, died last week at the age of 93. Over 700,000 people, almost 10% of the entire population of Israel, came out to view Ovadia Yosef's funeral procession. Rabbi Yosef was widely revered by his followers as a kind of living saint during his lifetime. He inspired songs extolling his virtues. His death is expected to further cement his iconic status in the ultra-Orthodox Sephardic community that he led. He was the first and perhaps only major ultra-Orthodox rabbinic figure to rule that preserving lives was more important than retaining territory for Israel, and his courageous decision on the status of abandoned women helped correct a long-standing injustice of Jewish law. In his later years, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef was also known for some very harsh comments about non-Jews, and sometimes Reform Jews, and his angry pronouncements against Israel's enemies. But Yosef is still being mourned far beyond the ultra-Orthodox Sephardic sector, thanks to the enormous emphasis he placed on religious outreach in a way Israel had never seen before. He courted the non-Orthodox, and he was the closest thing that Israel and the Sephardic world certainly had to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson. There is one other similarity between Yosef and Schneerson. Both left upon their death a huge power vacuum in their movements. For Yosef, the movement in question is Shas, the political party he established in 1984 with a network of associated welfare and educational institutions. The often used description of Ovadia Yosef as Shas's spiritual leader is a major understatement. The movement is from top to bottom an expression of his great intellect, his religious outlook, and his political ethos. The party's political leaders always consulted Yosef, who never himself sat in the Knesset, on every decision they made. In addition, Ovadia Yosef's son, Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, was recently elected the Sephardic Chief Rabbi of Israel, following in his father's footsteps, a position he will hold for the next 10 years. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, instantly recognizable by his lush gray beard, gold-embroidered robe, turban, and dark glasses, embodied a particular blend of religion, tradition, populism, and ethnicity. The Jewish people have lost one of the wisest men of this generation, Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu of Israel said. Rabbi Ovadia was a giant in Torah and Jewish law and a teacher for tens of thousands. President Shimon Peres said he had been at the rabbi's bedside hours before his death. When I pressed his hand, I felt I was touching history, and when I kissed his head, it was though I kissed the very greatness of Israel. In other news, President Obama's nomination of Janet Yellen to be the next chair of the Federal Reserve Bank will, if confirmed by the Senate, make her the first woman to lead the bank since its creation a century ago. But she'll be far from the first Jew. Yellen, whose nomination to head the bank came last week, will follow her immediate predecessor, Ben Bernanke, who is Jewish, and Bernanke's immediate predecessor, Alan Greenspan, was also Jewish. There have been two other Jewish Fed chairs in the past century, and in fact, the other frontrunner for the position besides Janet Yellen was Lawrence Summers. Yellen, 67 years old, was born into a working-class neighborhood in Brooklyn. Julius Yellen, a family doctor, was her dad, Anna Blumenthal, a schoolteacher, her mom. A recent profile of Yellen published described the family as Jewish, but not particularly observant. Yellen studied economics at Brown and Yale, spent 20 years in the academic world before joining President Clinton's economic team. She served as a Federal Reserve governor, chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, chair of the San Francisco Fed, and until now, vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. In these positions, Janet Yellen has established credentials as a leading economist. She was among the first to speak out against the dangers posed by subprime mortgages. Vice chair of the Fed, she supported Bernanke's policy of maintaining low interest rates and has viewed dealing with unemployment as the key challenge facing the Fed. In 1978, Janet Yellen married economist George Akerlof, who is also Jewish. Oh, and by the way, he won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2001. While living in Berkeley, they were members of the Reform congregation Bethel, where their only son attended preschool. In Budapest, Hungary, the shocking true story of a 19th century blood libel in which Hungarian Jews were accused of murdering a Christian girl for her blood is the subject of conductor Ivan Fischer's first opera, premiered this weekend in Budapest. The gruesome story, set to music in Fischer's one act, The Red Heifer, is based on an incident in the Hungarian village of Tisaslar, where Jews were accused of killing 14-year-old Esther Solimosi in 1883 to supposedly obtain blood to make matzah for Pesach, a horrible lie, a repetition of the infamous medieval Jewish blood libel. 15 Jews were tried and acquitted of the murder, but the case stirred enormous waves of anti-Semitism at the time. Composer Fischer, who is Jewish, said the case continues to have repercussions till today, when Solimosi's grave has become a pilgrimage site for Hungarians on the far-right neo-Nazi fringe. As in the 19th century, Hungary is again a battlefield between enlightened people who would like to join the Western world, especially Europe, and nationalist fundamentalists who feel threatened and create scapegoats, Fischer said. In today's premiere in Budapest, the program notes said that Fischer planned to write an opera based on this affair in the 1980s, around the century mark of its occurrence. He was inspired by a film, but then the filmmaker whom he hoped to work with passed away. "I've been thinking incessantly about composing this opera for 25 years, Fischer said. "The Tisaslar affair has become a present-day hot political issue. That finally helped me." And in further confirmation of the ridiculous success we Jews have enjoyed on the world intellectual scene, the Nobel Prizes announced so far in 2013 include three Israelis, Martin Karplus, Michael Levitt, and Arya Warshall, who won for chemistry for developing multi-scale models for complex chemical systems, and two of the three winners for medicine, James Rothman and Randy Shechtman. Somehow the third, Thomas Sudhoff, won, even though he's not Jewish. All three discovered a major transport system in our cells. The third prize announced in science, the Physics Nobel Prize, went to the guys working on the so-called God particle at the Hadron Collider in Switzerland. And again, they managed to win a Nobel Prize in spite of the handicap of not being Jewish. Not so the other five winners. Mazel tov to the 2013 Nobel Prize winners in the sciences. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Tzvi Eckstein, with his co-author, Maristella Botticini. He is the author of a book, The Chosen Few, which presents a thesis about how the transformation of the Jewish people towards a highly literate model, at least for boys, also set us up for success in the contemporary world. You mentioned that the original transformational process of moving from people focused on the rituals of the temple to the education and study of Torah took place in the land of Israel to an agricultural people, a farming people. How did that translate when they got to the diaspora?
Well, Jews live outside Israel at that time, and they were actually a center of Judaism during the mid-first millennium, has moved to Babylon. Actually, this was not viewed as a diaspora because the center of Judaism in Babylon, which is now Iraq, was a center of Judaism way before that. What has happened is that within this center, the Jewish religion has evolved as a very literate religion within a farming society in Babylon as well. So even in the diaspora in Babylon, Jews were farmers and centered around the yeshivas, which were really prosperous in the 7th and the 8th century. The key difference which happened is really the establishment of the Muslim Empire. The Muslim Empire in the 7th century generated a huge area from Iran all the way to Spain of free commercial activity with a center in a new city called Baghdad, with other cities around, which become the huge Muslim empire. And the Jews found themselves into becoming experts in being merchants and being artisan in the cities. And the transformation of the Jews from farmers to artisan in cities occur when almost 80% of the Jewish people were living in Babylon in the 8th to the 9th century. This has been documented by a lot of evidence on Jewish life from that time. So it's the diaspora as we know that today, meaning many, many Jews living in many, many cities and each community is small, has happened later in the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th century, in the late Middle Ages.
Kind of in the high point of the Muslim caliphate in the east, the growth of the Muslim empire to the west. So Jewish literacy fit right into that model.
Exactly. The Jewish literacy enabled the Jews, together with the religion, together with establishing a Jewish law, the Talmud, together with having a common language of the Jews, they generate a network of commerce, of traders, who start moving from one urban center to the next and become expert in trade. And within Jewish history, it's called the Golden Period. It was the golden period of religious practice. It was the golden period of economics. It was the golden period of Jewish prosperity culturally and ethnically. And that was basically was based on the literacy and the religious structure that enabled them to become, if you want to say, comparative to others, better in trade. as economists, we call it the comparative advantage of the Jews, become to be urban dwellers, and they basically specialize in any urban occupation that existed at that time. Almost 450 occupations were counted by one historian.
So I know that in the Cairo Geniza, there was a tremendous number of commercial documents, many of them Jewish commercial documents, that showed how widespread and in all the different areas of trade Jews were involved in the Muslim world, at least in the Eastern Mediterranean. But we know it extended all the way to Spain and was, you know, very extensive. How did those skill sets apply? Because the Jews that were living in the Christian world didn't have the same advantages.
Well, in fact, the Jews moved to the Christian worlds with equivalent advantages. I mean, we have privileges, which were charters, where were written by Jewish families who moved to France, moved to Italy, moved to Germany. And we have today the documents of those charters that were written by the families and extended to larger Jewish communities in the Christian world, both in Spain and in France, in Germany, in England later, in etc., where they basically got the option to be free traders. They could trade. They could settle, they could have their own rules, they can have their own judges. They were living in the center of the city. It's not that there were no atrocities against them or even restriction tried by competitors, but they were protected by the local bishop or the local prince or the king. And basically, there were no restrictions on Jewish activities in those Christians and Muslim communities, almost to the end of the 14th century. Most of the restrictions started later on in the, well, at the beginning of the 14th century, and then, of course, the expulsion from Spain by the end of the 15th century. So overall, we document using the data that historians have collected and historians have documented that the Jewish diaspora has been generated by Jews seeking commercial and urban activities, and they were welcomed by Christians and by Muslims all the way from Iran to Spain and later to England, because they provided skills that were not existed by the local population. And it is written literally in the reasons why the charters has been given to people who were probably blamed for killing Jesus, explicitly written there. The skills of the Jews and the skills of the Jews in being expert in occupations that related to trade and intermediation and doctors and moneylenders, who basically gave them the permission to be residents within Christian communities at that time in Europe.
There must have also been a certain commercial advantage to being able to move between communities in which had Jewish communities and having some built-in network of people that you could connect to.
That's what we document, and we show exactly that. They could communicate in Hebrew across different locations that were actually not connected, and they could do what economists now we call an arbitrage. So they could buy where it's cheap and sell where it's expensive, and provide these services to the developing world, especially the developing Europe at that time.
You know, it's fascinating to see the public hostility to Jews and an understanding of the leaders and the economic leaders of each community that the Jews were very valuable, and bringing them in even over against that hostility at times.
Yeah, they bring them over, and later they also kick them out.
Kick them out and take their money.
That it is most profitable to throw them away. The same thing happened in England, for example, right, in 1290, when the king signed a contract with the Lombards to replace the Jews as moneylenders, and 3,000 families of Jews left. Many times the Jews in Western Europe were moneylenders. They were expert moneylenders. They were doing very good providing financial services to the communities and to the kings and to the nobles. And then sometimes when economic conditions get bad and they were defaulting, and they were, rather than paying back, they kicked the Jews out. And the Jews suffered from that quite substantially.
Yeah, I think in France they did it 3 or 4 times.
They did it several times. You know, sometimes they actually throw them out, and then for a few years later they ask them to come back.
Right.
And this has been continued for years. And then eventually, toward the 16th century, most of the Jews start moving into Poland. And the Polish Jewish community has grown quite substantially and has never been expelled until the Nazis came and killed about 80% of this existing population at that time.
Professor Eckstein, one of the interesting pieces here, very interesting thesis altogether, that what prepared Jews for so much success in America and the other Western economies in the 20th and 21st centuries was this long heritage of deep devotion to literacy and education, which are now the coin of the realm in almost every field, and all of this experience in commerce. Can we expect Jews to continue to thrive in this environment?
I would say that the Jewish people had the advantage, especially when they moved from the 19th century to the 20th century, and the advantage become really large when they came to this free country in the U.S., where they become eventually free to move to any occupation. And then they basically excel through the academic learning to move into being both in academia but any other free occupation, and you know, in other success. And that came from the heritage of education, we think. We are working now on a book to try to establish that this is really the case. This is our hypothesis of their main economic outcomes during the periods after the destruction of the temple all the way to the end of the 15th century. We are working now on trying to see whether the same advantage was the key to their success and other aspect of their economic life. For example, a very important part of the development of the Jewish people was their very low infant mortality. And it's a big question why. There were low infant mortality in Poland, and they had actually a low infant mortality also in the United States relative to a lot of other urban dwellers. And that's kind of an interesting, whether that was also related to their education or it was related to other aspect of their cultural and religious background.
You make one final point. Education is expensive. Jews were willing to spend in order to educate their children. You note that people that weren't willing to pay this basically stopped being Jews.
Yeah, that's a key point that we make in our book. The Jewish population during the first 1500 years that we describe went down from around 5 million to 1 million or less. And we document that most of this, or a large part of this reduction in Jewish population, which occurred between the 3rd to the 6th, 7th century, probably as farmers, they had a hard time to pay for their Jewish education. And the poor and the unlucky and probably less talented probably shifted to the other competitive religion, which was Christianity. To some extent, we can see a parallel thing going on today, where the Jewish education doesn't provide any more economic edge relative to public education. And therefore, people who don't get the Jewish education, they probably end up practicing as Jews, especially those who are living in the U.S. So that's the description we have for the Jews in the first millennium, second half or the mid-first millennium, may have some similarity to what we see today in modern diaspora.
I want to thank Professor Zvi Eckstein for a great visit here on Too Jewish and a most lucid explanation for how Jews got to where we are today. His book is called The Chosen Few, and it's available from Princeton University Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to your audience. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Alexander Sasha Pavlovsky, the first violinist of the Jerusalem Quartet, the outstanding classical string ensemble. Our playout this morning comes from the same wonderful Jerusalem Quartet. They're here in Tucson, Arizona this week, where I live, playing at the Leo Rich Theater Wednesday and Thursday nights, and Thursday afternoon, too, for the Friends of Chamber Music. By all means, attend the Jerusalem Quartet. This piece is from a Mozart string quartet that they play superlatively well. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.